Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like? This is the Overton window at work. The idea, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically feasible at any one point. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues as they go from being unthinkable to plausible to policy and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, if you've been paying attention to the upcoming election, you know that lawmakers from all parties, candidates, politicians, everyone is talking about affordability. But exactly what they're going to do about affordability is often let out. And so John Phelan is filling in the blank with and has a long list of what they can do in his report, supplying hope and demanding real affordability and agenda for Minnesota's future. John is an economist at the Center of the American Experiment, a free market think tank in Minnesota. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
How does state policy make life more expensive?
Well, there's all sorts of ways that it happens. The kind of impetus behind this report, as you say, is that affordability is everywhere this year is a kind of buzzword. And everyone talks about it, but no one really knows what the issue is. So we hear lots of kind of misdiagnoses, and this leads to kind of, you know, bad remedies, non-remedies, actual remedies that aren't remedies but will make things worse being proposed. So very often what we find is that the issue is a question of a supply side one. So really the question that we have with the issue of affordability, and I think it's worthwhile to kind of separate out a kind of maybe macro picture from the supply side issues that we face. So we all know that the last few years has been a huge surge in inflation after a kind of four decade period when inflation was quite subdued. And I believe a lot of that is down to Federal Reserve money printing to finance the massive federal government spending during the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think that you've got to kind of separate that out. A lot of what people feel in terms of the affordability squeeze is that and its ongoing effects. I mean, inflation is still above target and not coming down anytime soon. And so I think a lot of people are feeling that squeeze, and that feeds into the affordability thing. Now, the state government can't really do very much about the Federal Reserve or the Treasury. But beneath that, you know, there are problems that the federal that the state government does cause. And so what I did in this report and what my co-authors did is to try and explain across a range of fields what it is that the state government is doing to exacerbate these individual instances of high prices and unaffordability, like housing or healthcare or energy, for example. So we have these all these issues which would be there whatever was happening at the federal level. I mean, if you go anywhere in America, they will tell you that their housing is expensive. You go to North Dakota and they will tell you housing is expensive here. But then you compare it to other places and it's not. So really what we're trying to do is not to explain the kind of macro picture in, you know, housing, you know, expenses, but the differences in this state and what state policymakers are doing to drive it. And really what the problem is, it's supply side issues. So state policymakers pass regulations, generally speaking, it's regulations. In some cases, it's a tax thing, but mostly it's regulations which restrict the supply of housing or childcare or healthcare or energy facilities. And so what they do is by restricting the supply, they raise the price. Now, you have to understand that that diagnosis is crucial. Because if you diagnose this as a supply side issue, which we do, then the solutions lay on the supply side. The solutions are to increase the supply. If, on the other hand, you think the problem is a demand side one, that the reason these things are unaffordable is just because people don't have enough money to spend, then you propose a whole bunch of other policies as fixes for this. And so the thing that illustrates this very clearly is housing in Minnesota. So we have unaffordable housing relative to kind of peer areas in the Midwest. And what we have is an awful lot of policymakers proposing that we fix this with handouts, cash handouts, taxpayer-funded subsidies. So we just give people money and that will make things affordable. These policies lower not a single price. They don't make anything more affordable. All they do is shift the cost from the individual to the taxpayer. Now, Minnesota already has some of the most heavily taxed citizens in the United States.
A lot of individuals are taxpayers.
Exactly. And so we have this issue where there's actually a further problem beyond that, because if you dump money, purchasing power, via these subsidies into a market where supply is constricted, like housing, for example, then all you're going to do is actually push prices up. This is actually, I hope, something that the left is kind of learning. There was that popular, well, popular among some, book Abundance that came out a couple of years ago by Derek Thompson and Ezra Klein, who are guys, I think, who kind of lean left. And their book is not totally brilliant, but it's, you know, kind of 50% good, which is better than you can generally expect, I think.
What I took from that is that they're writing for, you know, an audience that is fundamentally on the left. So if you're not in that audience, it's going to leave you a little flat. But trying to move, you know, people within their own coalition. So, you know, good on them.
Yeah, good luck to them. I mean, they need it. Tell you a quick story. I testified in the Minnesota State House Ways and Means Committee earlier this year, and I was talking about housing and exactly this issue. And as soon as I mentioned the book Abundance, half the Democrats on the committee rolled their eyes and like, oh God, here he comes with that neoliberal claptrap again. There's a kind of civil war on the left between, you know, old-fashioned, let's just throw more money at things, and a more sensible supply-side approach. That book, Abundance, should just have been called, you know, Left-Wingers Discover Supply-Side Economics 50 Years After Everybody Else Did, because that's basically all it is. But, you know, better late than never, I think.
Sure. Oh, so you're talking a lot of sense to me, and I think it's important to remember that, like, if you want to do something about inflation, you've got to ask the right people, and that's federal policymakers, Federal Reserve kind of people. But there's a lot that state lawmakers do that increase the cost of things. And if you want to lower the costs of things, it's not about redistributing resources. It's dealing with those policies that have made things more expensive. So can we narrow on housing for a little bit? Because I think that's a huge expense. It matters to a lot of people, and it's gone up an awful lot over the past few years. What can state lawmakers do to make housing less expensive?
Well, basically what they can do is, I mean, they're the people who've made it more expensive in the first place. And again, I have to say, you know, the question is not why is a house in Minnesota expensive relative to, say, I don't know, 1995 or something. The question is more, why is it more expensive in Minnesota than somewhere else? And we have an organization in the state, the Housing Affordability Institute, who did a really good study a couple of years ago now, where they looked at what it would cost to build a house in Lake Elmo, Minnesota, which is just kind of just north of the Twin Cities. And then they looked at what it would cost to build exactly the same house in Hudson, Wisconsin, which is like 20 miles away across the St. Croix. My brother-in-law lives there. Nice place. But what it was is they found out that it's something like $48,000 difference. There's some huge amount of difference between the construction costs of these two houses. Now, what's really interesting is I've gone in front of city councils and talked about this issue. And when I, you know, talk about, they highlight these differences and I say, that's the difference you have to explain. You know, everyone in America, like I say, says housing is expensive. But the question for you, local policymaker, is to explain why it is more expensive here than it is 20 miles across the state line in Wisconsin. And you get all these kind of crazy answers. You'll get some people will tell you lumber's expensive. Well, they're buying the same lumber in Hudson, Wisconsin, 20 miles away. Labor's expensive. Well, they're drawing from the same labor pool. Hudson, Wisconsin is even in the Twin Cities MSA. And so, you know, you get these kind of
statistical area.
Yeah.
It basically means that if you live in there, you might work in across state lines. You might work in that general metropolitan area.
Exactly. So none of these explanations hold water. And what was really interesting is it was Edina City Council, very affluent Twin Cities suburb. And once you knock through all these crazy explanations, one of the council members said to me, well, you know, we have more green housing here. We have more green mandates. You know, our houses are more environmentally friendly than they are in Hudson, Wisconsin. And I thought, well, there you go. Now we've finally got to it. We've finally got to something. One of the reasons that affordable housing is so rare in Minnesota is because you people have made it rare. You people have effectively amputated the bottom of the supply curve with these taxes, fees, and regulations that you pile on in the name of some, you know, green goal. And it's really kind of, once you get down to that thing, what are the things that you do? And so in the report, what we do is we kind of dig into some of these policies, and most of them actually are green things, energy mandates. They're actually fairly recent as well. We had some brought in 2023. And these green energy mandates, essentially what we're saying, or what these policymakers are saying, is that we are willing to sacrifice affordable housing for these green goals. And I think that's fine.
And the green goals are just housing, houses using less energy, using less gas to heat their homes, less electricity to maintain, you know, the household.
Absolutely. And so, you know, these people need to realize that the problems you talk about of affordability are the consequences of the actions you have taken on the supply side. You have, you know, crippled the supply side of the economy. You have amputated the bottom of the supply curve, the affordable part of the supply curve, and you've done it for these other goals. Now, if you think these other goals are worth that, then that, admit that. But what they're trying to do is to create the problem and then deny that they've created it. And that's when you come in with the whole thing about credit. So, yeah, okay, we trashed affordability in the name of pursuing these green goals. Here's some money from the taxpayers to fix all this. But of course, taxes are another squeeze on affordability. Minnesotans, as I said, are some of the most heavily taxed citizens in the United States. We don't just tax the richest people very, very highly. We actually have one of the top rates of personal income tax in America, but it kicks in at a much lower rate. I think only Oregon has a higher rate on a lower threshold than we do. So we tax people as rich in Minnesota who would not be considered rich in almost any other state. And even if you look at the average earner in Minnesota, the average earner, they hand over more of their earnings in taxes to the state government than average earners in, I think, 45 other states. So this whole idea that we can fix the full...
not just income taxes either. You've got sales taxes, you've got property taxes, yep. You've got business taxes.
Absolutely. So the idea that we can fix this problem by just kicking it all over to the taxpayer... we can't afford to do that. We really need these supply side measures, and that's what we talk about in the report.
There was something I learned in your report about a unique government entity called the Met Council that does strange things in housing policy. Can you explain their land rationing?
So the Met Council actually goes back, I think, about nearly 60 years. It goes back to the 1960s, I believe. And it was instituted by Republican politicians. Minnesota Republicans were very different then, perhaps, to Republicans now. But the idea was that there were all these kind of things like water planning and water usage, pipes and all the rest of it. That needed to be done at a level above Hennepin and Ramsey County. Hennepin is Minneapolis, Ramsey County is St. Paul, and the surrounding counties in the metro area, Dakota County, et cetera, you know, even a couple of those ones over in Wisconsin.
Regional collaborations on big public works projects. Makes sense
indeed,
to me, right?
Indeed, but the kind of structure of the Met Council is bizarre. It's all appointed. No one's elected to it. It actually does have tax-raising powers as well. So it's almost unique, I think.
In taxation without representation.
Exactly. You know, no one really knows how it works apart from about five people. And not all of those people are on the council, by the way. It's very, very opaque. But one of the things it does is it kind of rations the land that is used for housing development in the Twin Cities. And it does this in all sorts of ways, but primarily... there's a kind of hard boundary around the areas that you can develop, and you can't go beyond that. So what if you look at if you've ever been to the Twin
to say that it's not just zoning, and I assume that there's zoning there's local, you know, plans about real estate, but there's this extra regional authority that has said, in addition to all those other rules, you just can't build housing here.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of interesting. If you look at San Francisco, for example, I mean, that place is small. It's surrounded on three sides by water. You can kind of understand why housing might be expensive there, because supply really is constricted by the geography. If you've been to the Twin Cities, you'll know that's just not the case. I mean, it's flat as a pancake for miles and miles and miles. So there shouldn't really be these problems. And yet you have the Met Council, which effectively acts around the Twin Cities like the water around San Francisco, by creating this artificial kind of hard boundary. And so what it is, you know, if you want to get into the Twin Cities, you know, you've got to live in this area if you want to get housing there. Otherwise, you've got a much longer commute.
I mean, I assume there have been discussions about the value that this is providing and alternative ways of doing it. Where does discussion about the Met Council land?
It's interesting because the Met Council is almost this kind of sacred cow. It goes almost under the radar. We actually believe that it should be abolished or massively reformed to become some kind of elective thing, although that's very much a kind of distant second choice. But this, it's not a matter that comes up for discussion ever. I can't remember in my 9 years here now, anybody seriously talking at the state capitol that we should just nix this thing and start from scratch. But, you know, it's one of those things, you know, once things are in place, they're very, very hard to move. And so, you know, like Reagan said, you know, about government bureaucracies are the closest thing to, you know, eternal life on Earth. I mean, the Met Council is a perfect example of that, really.
Well, and it's another issue that you get, which is your local development community adapts to the boundaries that are placed by state law, because a lot of the housing market is not, or at least you're not competing over who can build the cheapest, safest, best homes. You're competing over who gets allowed to build anything at all. And if that's the competition, you're not going to criticize those people that you have to work with in order to accomplish your goals.
That's absolutely true. It kind of creates like an insiders-outsiders situation. So, you know, people who can get in and develop inside this, you know, boundary, they really don't want the boundary to go away because it pushes everything up. And of course, you know, homeowners are in on this as well. There isn't really a kind of huge demand for, I mean, everyone wants housing to become more affordable, but no one wants the price of their house to fall.
Yes, it's a simple thing, really. Yeah. Housing should be cheap when you're trying to buy and expensive when you're trying to sell.
Yeah, I think there's a fundamental issue. You see this across, you know, that awkward phrase, the Anglo-Saxon world. The British and the Irish are very similar to this, and their property markets are absolutely ruined as well, by the way. But the idea that housing is kind of an asset, you know, that you live in and is kind of an investment vehicle rather than something that you kind of consume as you go. And so people, once you start to think of it as an asset, you expect it to appreciate in value. I mean, that can't really happen endlessly. But we've tried that for the last couple of decades.
Yes. So we've only covered a couple of the policy recommendations, talked about the issue. And there's 40-some, dozens at least is a good way of putting it. And people can check out those specifics, but I want to talk about the politics involved here. So you're every politician saying they're going to do something about affordability. You've got a list. You should be really popular with them, right? How's that working?
Well, you'd think so, but it's a difficult thing. So on the left, we talked a bit about that kind of divide. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people on the left who just want to throw money at these problems because that's all they know how to do. It's difficult in Minnesota because...
And by the way, if you're the recipient of these subsidies, you don't necessarily care what the base costs are. You're happy that the government is helping you to pay for these things. It does make your life more affordable, even if it's just transferring responsibility costs to other people.
Absolutely. So there's a constituency for this. There's a constituency that does benefit from this. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the politics, you've got one half of, I suppose, the Democrats who are completely against this because they just believe in spending money. There's another group of Democrats. I don't really know how many they are because they keep their heads down because they're terrified of being screened at meetings, who probably agree with us on a lot of these things. And housing is the area where there is some kind of overlap on this.
And by the way, you're pointing out the Democrats a lot, in part because that's who controls state policy in Minnesota right now, right?
Exactly, yeah. It's actually, there's a great line actually in the Abundance book, and I quote it fairly closely, which is that, you know, they talk about California, but you know, the same goes for Minnesota. But if you look at, and Klein and Thompson say, if you look at California, Democrats have held every elected position in that state for decades. They should be able to point to California and say, if you elect us, we will run the country like we run California. Instead, Republicans point to California and say, if you elect them, they will run the country like they run California. I mean, I think if anything cooks Gavin Newsom, it should be that, really. But we have those issues in Minnesota, you know, and so the Abundance Democrats here are very, you know, kind of they keep their heads down. But we also have issues on the right as well, on the Republican side, because, again, you know, the question of who's an insider, who's an outsider is not clear cut. It's not, you know, red or blue. And so when you start to talk about, you know, we need to, you know, massively expand housing supply, remove these regulations and whatnot, you do get a lot of pushback from certain Republicans, actually. You know, everyone can be a bit of a NIMBY. And also, you know, things like, so one thing that we're pushing in terms of energy is nuclear energy. We've had a moratorium on building nuclear energy plants in Minnesota going back more than 30 years, I think. And there's currently a move, which has some bipartisan support, to get rid of that moratorium and to build nuclear energy plants, and that will kind of bring energy costs down. But this is not something Republicans like either. Or, you know, a Republican and a Democrat are almost as likely to dislike or dislike it, you know. So that's an interesting one. You can go through and find lots of things like that. Weirdly, also another crazy policy we have, this is not uncommon actually across states, is the certificate of need laws around medical facilities. So it's a perfect example. We actually ration the amount of hospital bed space that there is in Minnesota. We say, this is how much you can have. And if you want to add to this, you need to go through some whole long process. You have to get permission from the state legislature to build, you know, to expand to this capacity. It's insane. But it's been there, again, this too, I think, for more than 30 years. And there isn't much appetite across either party really to get rid of it. And again, it's the insiders outsiders thing. The people who are in the medical market, they don't want it expanded. They're collecting their rent and they don't want anyone coming in and taking that away.
And the rent being the gains that they've gotten from these policies, not collecting, you know, rent that they're charging their customers.
Yeah, rent in the kind of rent seeking sense, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a public policy term. It's not about the price of monthly price of housing. Just want to point that out. I think it's important. But I do want to dwell on the politics here, because it is bizarre that every lawmaker, Republican, Democrat, is running on affordability, saying that they're going to do something about affordability. And yet, when it comes to the policies, they don't want to do any of them. Mm. Like shouldn't it be easy then to say, look, we're going to do to make it easier to build housing, and that's going to help a lot of people pay their rent. It's going to help a lot of people. Shouldn't that be a more popular message than it is? Because their lawmakers aren't doing that. They're just making vague overtures about affordability.
Yeah, it's difficult. I think one of the issues is the primary thing that we have. So to navigate a primary in Minnesota, and it's probably the same everywhere, you first have to appeal this way or that way, depending on which party you are. Angie Craig, a Congresswoman here, She was always the kind of the archetypal moderate Democrat in the House, and she decided to run for the empty Senate seat. But she had to become a kind of crazed left winger. And so she abandoned all these sensible positions that she'd once had, moved hard to the left. It didn't work out for her because there was somebody even crazier than her. And so they got the nomination. And so you've got to kind of appeal in the first instance to a very unrepresentative group of people. And both sides have this, you know. I mean, generally speaking, the people who have time and resources to some extent to turn up to these kind of endorsing conventions are not representative of your average Minnesotan or your average, you know, Wisconsinite, Iowan, North Dakota, whatever. And so we end up with these kind of crazy situations. So you have to kind of say things which are a bit bonkers. This kind of, you know, supply side thing, well, it doesn't fly well in endorsing conventions.
Yeah. Let me push back a little bit, because it's like, look, they're trying to tell people what they want to hear. These are Democratic primaries or Republican primaries, and it's the people who are most politically engaged that get to determine who makes it to the next step. They gets in this situation where it's possible for them to be elected. Are they really bonkers to take their own ideas seriously?
Well, I think to some extent, if you look at the issues that they care about, they're not the issues that most people care about. So you can say that they're bonkers because they're concerned about X, Y, Z, or maybe they're kind of rational actors because they have, you know, concerns and they're acting on those. The real difficulty is that they're not representative because, so for example, if you look at the people who go to Republican endorsing conventions, they tend to be older, they tend to be homeowners. And so they don't really want to see a solution to housing affordability that involves the building of a lot of housing and the lowering of house prices. And so that is a problem, you know. So once you've got through that, you've got to try and attack back to the middle or somewhere close to the middle. And also, again, you know, a lot of these things, you wonder how popular they are. Everyone likes affordability in the abstract. But nobody necessarily wants affordability if it means their house price stagnates or, you know, goes down something. And so it is a difficulty. Again, it's insiders and outsiders.
Although there are some pieces of affordability that are at least less, you know, some winners and losers than others. I think most people would prefer it if childcare costs were down, if their electricity costs were down, if their tax costs were down, at least ceteris paribus, all things being equal.
Yeah, I think the health thing and the energy thing are very big on that. Again, you come there. I mean, so some of the really big players in state politics here are the health companies and Xcel Energy. I mean, Xcel Energy, you know, they're almost like a kind of government department in some respects. You know, they work so closely with government appointees on the PUCs to set rates. To call them a kind of private business is not really accurate. I mean, to some extent, you know, they're almost nationalized, a kind of arm's length nationalized, or whatever the state version of nationalization is. But that does give them a very, very strong incentive to push against some of these policies. It also gives them a very powerful position from which to push that position.
Mm-hmm. So we've gotten this situation where it's popular to say that you're going to do something about affordable, but any particular policy isn't always going to be popular. What are you doing to make your recommendations more feasible?
Well, we actually have got a campaign going at the moment. We do a lot of polling in Minnesota, because you want to get some idea of what people think. And generally, you know, what they really think rather than what the people you talk to think. Because, again, people you talk to might not be representative. And so there are certain things that come across very consistently in that polling, one of which is that people think their taxes are too high. and so, you know, we've got all these various things. One of the things we found also is that Minnesotans, by some huge number now, believe that the state is on the wrong track. And if you go back, we've been running this question, poll question for about 7-8 years now. And if you go back 7 or 8 years, people, Minnesotans were quite pleased with how the state was. Right track was way up on wrong track by something like 10 points or something like that. Now it's completely the other way around. And we actually had a poll a little while ago that found that wrong track was 65% and right track was like 35% or something. You know, so many, there's a real feeling of discontent here. And so what we're trying to do is trying to say to people, well, look, you're cheesed off. Here's why, and here are our solutions. So we have this big campaign, Wrong Track Minnesota. And if you go onto our website, you can find that. And we list, you know, some bullet points, because you've really got to find, I think, if you're going to convince people with all the will in the world. I mean, I love the report that we've done, but I don't think a lot of people are going to plow through the whole thing. It's not the Da Vinci Code, you know, which is why, you know, you have 40 sentences, actually, which are the precise recommendations. If you read nothing else, read that, the executive summary, that basically tells you what we want to communicate. But we're trying to put that, you know, to as many people as possible by boiling it down to those effectively bullet points. You stuck them on, you know, and not a meme, but some kind of graphic. And we have a comms department that pushes those out on social media, because we really want to embed in people's minds these simple messages, you know, that there is a real problem, there is a real solution, and don't be fooled by this thing, which is actually not a solution, but will exacerbate the problem.
Which is another way of saying our lawmakers are not doing these things that we recommend, but you're creating, you're showing that, but they are going to be popular, and that they, that lawmakers, voters, their supporters think that there's something different that needs to happen, and that there's a sense of urgency for lawmakers to consider other ideas, which is a way of saying, like, look, you don't have to believe you and your colleagues. You can look at your own voters and show that these things are in demand.
Yeah, I mean, if we talk about the Overton window, you know, you go again, to go back to the polling on right track, wrong track in the state. One of the missions that I suppose we've had is to convey to people in Minnesota the kind of reality of the economic situation. So, for example, if you go back to 2014, GDP per capita in Minnesota was like $4,500 above the national level. It's fallen every year, that premium. And so that in 2025, for the first time on record, GDP per capita in Minnesota was below the national rate, because per capita GDP growth has lagged the national rate in Minnesota in every one of the years since 2014. Only Wisconsin matches that record. And so you've got to, Minnesotans tend to think they're a prosperous state with all these wonderful things, you know, good schools and safe streets and all the rest of it, which was true once upon a time. But it's less and less true as time goes on. So one of the issues in terms of policy, you know, if you're looking at moving the Overton window, one of the things you have to do, and we've had to do in the first instance, is to cut through and give people the reality of the situation. Because one of the problems we have here is the local state media stinks. It is absolutely almost entirely in the pocket of a particular political party. And I swear to God, when Democrats get in trouble, they must have like a light somewhere that they shine up into the clouds, and it says, you know, Star Tribune or KSTP, and the journalists come running and produce some absolute nonsense to try and dig the Dems out of a hole.
So I guess one of your opportunities then is, if you're not going to be get sympathetic coverage from the people who are communicating most to Minnesotans, that you have your own avenues to get your message out.
Exactly. We have to be kind of evangelists for free markets. And it's not enough just to kind of go and speak to legislators, because it depends which legislators are there. You know, so we've actually got to convince the people of Minnesota to vote for, in the first instance, to vote for legislators who will pursue sound ideas, whichever party they belong to. You know, because there's numpties on both sides, and there's good people on both sides. The ratio is different.
I'm unfamiliar with the term specifically. I can pick it up by context.
It's one of the more polite ones I can use. So, But yeah, so that's what we have to do. In the first instance, our audience is a mass audience. So we have a very kind of highly developed, I think, comm strategy. We've won a lot of awards for this, SPN. We do billboards, you know, we put billboards up on some of the big freeway things. And we do radio ads, things like that. We do a lot of social media, and we start to do a podcast. We do clips of the podcast and they become little videos. To some extent, you know, look, I wish people would sit and read the white papers and the reports, but you've got to deal with reality and you've got to deal with the fact that most people won't do that. And so you've got to find them where they are and meet them where they are and give them the information in a method which they will digest.
I mean, don't knock the white paper. The white paper is important, as I'm sure you know. Like, you have to show that you know what you're talking about. You have to make a sophisticated, clever argument. You have to address objections. You have to, you know, deal with the nitty-gritty of the policy proposal and show people that you know what you're talking about. And there is no substitute for that, even if few people are going to read the whole report.
Yeah, I mean, look, the white paper is really where it all begins. If you don't write the white papers, you've got nothing to put on your meme, you know? So the white papers are absolutely essential, you know, for a policy organization, that's where it starts. And we've always done those at the center, but what we've really done in the last few years is ramp up, our efforts to convey those messages to a wider audience. And so I think that's, we've had a lot of success with that. I think that shows, in some of the polling and kinds of attitudes that people have, besides just the statistics in terms of reach and all the rest of it that comms people like to throw at you.
John, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton Window.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.